Welcome back. The St. Louis Symphony's 2016-2017 program schedule was released this week, and a full schedule it is, involving scores of performances beginning in September and extending well into the following spring. We'll be hearing some things that are familiar and some firsts. I sat down with the orchestra's president and CEO, Marie-Hélène Bernard, and music director David Robertson yesterday. Marie-Hélène joined the symphony last July. Fixing the next season's schedule is already underway. I asked her about joining the process after it had already started.
It's not very difficult at all, actually, because when you come new to an organization, you're taking quite some time to observe and see what the organization has been doing and the orchestra, the sound of it, and David's philosophy and the way he programs. So there's a learning curve that happens, and it was actually pretty easy because I already knew a little bit about what David was planning for this season and was already very taken by some of the ideas and programs that he had put in place with our team.
It seems like the process, David, has been underway for a long, long time, as obviously it has. Why so long?
Well, many of the artists have engagements in their calendar several years out. In general, you usually start booking things in your calendar about 4 years ahead of time. So I can tell you where I will be on a specific date in 2020. Sure. And that means that just in terms of making sure that you get the artists that you and the audience would like to have means booking them in advance. And then there's the question, which is usually decided a little bit later, if they're guest artists, which pieces they're interested in doing. A pianist or a violinist may carry 5 to 7 concertos in any one season, but more than that, and then they start having difficulty really keeping everything up to shape at the level that they would like. So there's that to take into consideration. And then there's the question of what the orchestra has done in past seasons, mm-hmm. the question of what one feels the community really gets excited about and what sells tickets, and at the same time, what the mission of the organization is, because if the St. Louis Symphony doesn't play a piece, who in the area, if you put the point of a compass down here and the pencil is drawing out within a 300-mile radius of St. Louis, who is going to hear these pieces? And so there are all of these various different aspects that come together when you're planning things, and they all kind of, like little dominoes, they all fall at slightly different times in the calendar process.
When it comes to the artists, the guest artists, which is first, the chicken or the egg? Do you think of the artist first, or do you think of what they would play?
You know, it's a combination of both. There are times when you think, oh, this would be a really great piece to have. Let's see who plays it or who performs it or who sings it. On the other hand, there are times a little bit later in this season, there's a program that was really built around the fact of one soloist that we knew could do both Claude Vivier's Lonely Child and the final vocal movement of Mahler's Fourth Symphony. And this is the amazing Susanna Phillips. Mm-hmm. And while she is able to do all of these incredible things, I still had to say, would you mind doing this Vivier piece? Would you like to do the Mahler? And she had a look at the Vivier piece and said, yes, this is great. I'd love to do this. Let's do this. And then there are other times when you're looking for a specific piece. Let's say that we're going to do something like the Beethoven Violin Concerto. At the level that this orchestra plays at, there aren't very many violinists in the world who play it at that level. Another example, later in the coming season, we have the Brahms Violin Concerto. And so we needed to look around and see whether we could find someone of the stature of the orchestra. And there in Augustin Haderlich, we definitely found someone who plays that at a world-class level. And then that's appropriate. So it really is kind of something that goes in both ways.
Now I understand why it takes so long.
Yeah.
Marie-Hélène, what I'm seeing here, tell me if I'm wrong, is a storyboard. Mm-hmm. Like thing,
yeah.
Where you have
absolutely
pieces of paper that you stick in. Mm-hmm. And is that the way it works?
Yeah, and it's about shaping artistic experiences. And while we plan one season, David and our team always, you know, keep an eye on 2, 3, 4 seasons in advance, and also, you know, feeling new talent, emerging talent, and looking at opportunities to bring things here in St. Louis that would not otherwise be done.
When you came into the process in July, what did you bring to the table in terms of ideas that were implemented?
You know, that's a good question. I'm not sure I can answer this that specifically, because I'm much more interested in having conversation and a dialogue with David about what do we want this orchestra to showcase? What are we good at? What are the opportunities in terms of repertoire, the projects that, you know, will excite the audiences and things that we could do differently? And how does that fit into the DNA of the St. Louis Symphony? But also it speaks of the guests that we invite when David is not in town, is what kind of talent is a good fit for the St. Louis Symphony? There's a lot of research that's involved in that. And we can all express musical preferences, personal preferences, but I think one of David's strengths and with our team is really to think about our community. What speaks of what they would want to hear, but also things that they might not know they will like, that mm-hmm. you will bring to the stage and really create experiences that are truly unique.
You speak of a team. Oh, who absolutely. Are members of the team?
Yes. So, of course, besides David, there's Brett Dorhout, who's our VP of Artistic Planning. Mm-hmm. And he has several members of his team who look for talent, who flesh out programs, who really oversee the technical aspects of really the programming, which is very complex. As David said, it takes years. There's numerous conversations. If David is doing a Mozart Requiem, he needs a cast for singers. So the dance of contacting agents and finding the talent and making sure that he can find voices, artists who are available, and then David is going to express preferences for some artists, and then it's the dance. It's really like, as you said, a domino effect. It's just, so it's a lot of several weeks and months of contacting, discussing, negotiating. It takes time.
So obviously there is a team, but I suspect that the buck stops with you two when it comes to decision time.
I mean, it's very interesting. The board is very clear. Mm-hmm. For the artistic things, they make me responsible. So my head's on the chopping block when there are lots of letters that no one liked the piece that was played last night. Her head's on the chopping block if it costs too much. So we have this partnership where, you know,
need to make it work.
Where we have to make things work. But you're absolutely right. For example, Brett and I will sit down and we'll work on various ideas, both on the long term, as Marilyn explained, and then also on the short term. And sometimes what's really great in a good team is just like in basketball when you get one of these sort of handoffs where it looks like the two people are playing as one as the ball moves down the court and then goes into the hoop. The same thing where Brett and I will start talking and ideas will ricochet off of each other. And it's very hard to tell in the end who actually came up with the program. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of thing that you want to see all the time. And someone like Adam Crane is really great at seeing opportunities within the community as mm-hmm. the director of external affairs, how we can do things with the orchestra that are outside of what you would think of as the normal job of a symphony orchestra. And that's, of course, where having a really great team at all the mm-hmm. levels is very important.
And I would add to the team David Niswich, the head of marketing, who also has a voice because he's going to look at program and yeah. he has a musical background and he's going to have an eye for things or experiences that he foresees and going to say, oh, cautioning us. Careful here, maybe you want to think about this. And also our VP of operations, who actually makes it happen on stage. She might see programming on paper that technically will cause difficulties or will be maybe more challenging, and she'll remind David, oh, I have you thought about this? So it's really teamwork. So, and I think in the end, it doesn't really matter who, you know, has been instrumental in making this happen. For us, it's the vision of David Robinson with the St. Louis Symphony. So that's really what it comes down to.
This is obvious a process that most people don't understand if they've never been involved, and most members of the public wouldn't understand. I wonder if we could try something. That is, you're starting with Kurt Weill's Lindbergh, correct? Mm-hmm. That's going to be obviously in mid-September. Can you give me some sense of what the conversation was like deciding that this is what you were going to start with?
Sure. So first of all, you brainstorm about what are the things that are going on. And one of the, you know, obvious connections is that it's 90 years since Charles Lindbergh got in the Spirit of St. Louis and flew from the United States over to Europe. First time anyone had flown solo across the Atlantic. And this was an adventure that is hard to imagine now, both how it captured the public's imagination and how just daredevil it really was. You know, flying was at that time an extraordinarily dangerous and exciting activity.
And new.
And very new. So Lindbergh caught everyone's imagination. And we thought, well, you know, the Spirit of St. Louis lives on in so many ways in the community and in the orchestra. And how can we look at this? And I had known of this piece, having seen a score, but it's very rarely performed. And so we looked at it and I said, yes, actually, it would be great to do it. And then I started thinking about what works we could put with it, because it's an unfamiliar work. And so you naturally need to have works on the program that the audience says, oh, yes, I know that. That's okay. So I'm happy to go in, you know, like a restaurant. I know that their veal is really good, so I'm happy to try this other thing in the prefix menu and see if it's okay. And so you need to find a piece that's like that. At the same time, you don't want to artistically leave the Kurt Weill and Bertolt Brecht Lindbergh piece out as an orphan in the program, mm-hmm. so that it doesn't feel like it fits. So what story can you tell? Well, in a sense, if you look at what Lindbergh's flight represents in a lot of different ways, you can look at it in terms of, first of all, it's a solo flight. But second of all, it's one man plus technology doing something mm-hmm. absolutely miraculous. Going back to Icarus and this dream of being able to traverse space. And what is it that he's traversing? He's going across a huge distance. And so, like some sort of stone thrown in the pond, this sends out ripples in our ideas right across the whole season. And we pick these up in various ways. But in the first program, to make it very clear, we have the Lindbergh Cantata. It's a radio play. We'll actually present it as a radio broadcast with an announcer and so forth. Your colleague Charlie Brennan will be out there to do it like a real kind of radio show. Mm-hmm. And then after the intermission, we have the mm-hmm. piece of Pierre Boulez, which is called Dialogue of the Double Shadow. And in this, it is very definitely a musical solo flight, as there's a single clarinetist on stage who is playing this music, which is picked up and processed by a computer in real time and sent all through the whole hall through different loudspeakers. So there's this real conquest of space from one lone musician standing on the stage. And here again we have one man and his technology allowing something miraculous to take place. And of course the whole notion of this is sort of the double shadow. And what is that double shadow, the dialogue of the double shadow? It's this same thing that happens when Lindbergh is in his airplane.
Spirit of St. Louis.
And the Spirit of St. Louis, and really his only companion is the motor in the plane. And so the shadow of Lindbergh and the shadow of his plane fuse together into this double shadow across the water. And of course, the water that they're going across is the sea. And so going from America to Europe and to France particularly, it made perfect sense to have the sea of Debussy be the final work. And so we finish with La Mer. And so what we hope to accomplish by something like this is a program where if you come in and just like the tunes and an interesting sonic experiment, you will have that. If you are interested in looking at it on much deeper levels and many different deeper levels, it's all there for you to come in and get what you like. So a little bit like a sort of an open-ended artwork that can continue to resonate for each person at a slightly different frequency according to the tuning of their own soul.
So, Marie-Hélène, there is an intellectual component to all of this, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Do you think that shuts some people out?
I don't think so. I think what we do with a season like this, which has so much, such great variety of repertoire and so many experiences we can offer, is for us, it's how do you translate the musical experiences so people want to come and hear it. And there's many ways to do this. So I don't think, actually, I think the orchestra, the St. Louis Symphony, is pretty good about making the experience attractive for what it is, for the music, and really sharing this excitement about the emotion that you're going to experience when you come and listen to St. Louis Symphony, and not so much about what you know. I think we would feel that if you leave a concert wanting to know more about a composer or about the music or something we have given you, then I think we've done our job. But the knowledge of what you're going to experience, you know, it's something that's very personal. Mm-hmm. Some people feel they need to know more about some others, but we really want people to embrace it for what it is and to make it a personal experience. Their knowledge does not validate what they hear. It's really a very personal way. We're going to be sitting in the same concert hall and experience the music in very different ways, and still it's the same performance.
Kind of like a parallax view. People can see, hear the same music and not interpret it perhaps the
same
way.
And we want to encourage people to come to St. Louis and for you and experience the music and not worry so much about what they know or don't know.
Our own Bob Duffy, in writing about your new season schedule, said there was an aeronautical theme, and obviously Lindbergh fits into that. Is there an aeronautical theme throughout the season, and do you like themes?
I do like themes. I mean, what I think is interesting is, and I often use a menu for this example, you put four courses together and they immediately, the tastes are in dialogue with your taste buds. The same thing if you go to a gallery and you see four pictures together in the same room. They speak to each other, even if they're from completely different painters and from great distance in terms of time of when they were painted. So the same thing happens in not only one concert, but in many concerts. And one of the things that happens, for example, is that you have Lindbergh flying across the Atlantic, and he knew where he was going, and people were very excited to have him there. At the close of the season, when you have the Flying Dutchman, things are slightly reversed. Here's someone who is forced to wander forever until he finds someone who will love him truly, and he has to take his whole crew along with him. And so there's a certain bitterness to this idea of faithfulness in human affairs that is expressed in that piece, and there's the longing for homecoming. At the same time, we have Mozart's Requiem combined with the Transmigration of Souls, which is the work that John Adams wrote for 9/11, and of course it's 15 years since 9/11, whereas another case where here's someone who takes an airplane and does something quite different than Lindbergh does. And of course, one of the things that you alluded to earlier is I think the intellectual things are exciting, but you don't necessarily need, as Marie-Hélène said, to engage with it on an intellectual level to get a great deal of enjoyment from it. The difference, I think, is that classical music tends to have a relatively small market by comparison to the large market of music people consume. And the reason for this is that we're actually asking you to pay full attention. And what people find when they pay full attention to the music, whatever kind of music it is, whether it's that of John Williams or it's gospel music or it's, you know, a medley of the Beatles, or it's a Beethoven symphony, or it's a work that they've never heard before by a living composer, what they find is that their interaction with it is vastly more intense than when they hear music as a support to a television show or as background in a restaurant or playing loudly in a club. All of a sudden, the music takes on a different sort of quality. And this is something, you know, that we connect up with in a lot of ways. And I think Bob is right. There are many different areas of flight. There's a program which is absolutely wonderful, and you don't need to really understand it, I think, in an intellectual way. Near the end, I mentioned Augustin Hadlich coming to play the Brahms Violin Concerto, which is a work that is both at times very sweet and extremely sad and hugely uplifting and joyful and boisterous. And these would seem to be conflicting qualities. And yet, if we were to read a brilliant short story, say George Saunders, or a great novel, we wouldn't be at all surprised to find these very different emotions in the same work of art. So on that program, we begin with Elgar's String Serenade, which is an absolutely gorgeous and luscious piece. And you could say, well, it has no intellectual connection with the Brahms, other than that they're both beautiful pieces. And in between is a work by the contemporary composer Georges Lenz, who's from Luxembourg but lives in Australia. And it's a piece that I've performed before called Jerusalem. And it's connected up to the Jerusalem really evoked in Blake's late kind of hermetic poetry. So it's really apocalyptic kind of idea of Jerusalem, this Book of Revelation Jerusalem. And at the end of it, you have a reference to the Malaysian Airlines flight that suddenly disappeared, and we didn't know why. And he thought about at 9/11, there were all sorts of people in the towers who were on their cell phones calling loved ones before the towers fell. And here at the end of the piece, he does something absolutely incredible with cell phones, which I won't give away. It would be a spoiler alert to do so. And it is absolutely haunting in a way that somehow, at some deep level, perhaps beyond what words can intellectually express, it does what music can do and takes us to a place that I don't think anything else can quite match. And in a sense, for us, that's what we're trying to do when we put together a program. Not simply a collection of pieces, but the possibility to open up an experience for each and every audience member, regardless of their background or their personal experiences with music, that can take them to a place that they have never been before and that nothing else will do.
Marie-Hélène, that must have been quite a conversation, given what David has just said,
yeah.
A conversation coming up with this program.
Yeah.
Because, you know, as he just explained it here, it must have been an emotional meeting.
Oh, absolutely. And another very exciting part of our job is once the season is put together is to take it to the community, get the support for it, and share the excitement and the many connections that David just explained, you know, between music and literature or political events or life. And, you know, music is about life. So when you touch people's lives in a way that's very personal, that's where you really transform a community. And we have a very supportive business philanthropic community in St. Louis, and it's a joy to be able to take them on this journey and to get them excited about this music so that they open the networks to get more people to hear it. And it makes it for a very, very special experience.
Is the operation financially secure at this point?
Yes, we are actually in a good place, and we will have more to share very soon. But we're working really hard finalizing a strategic plan, and really we'll be able, with great excitement, to share the planning for the next 5 years and sustaining great artistic excellence, but also making sure we remain relevant to our community and we continue to grow wisely in great fiscal shape, absolutely always.
And you're taking the show on the road, if you don't mind that expression. I know you're going to Carnegie Hall.
Yes, next season, in connection with John Adams' 70th birthday, David and our team will take John Adams' The Gospel According to the Other Mary to Carnegie Hall in March of 17, which is a great honor. And we have other plans in the works, which we'll share very soon about touring, future touring.
One other thing I wanted to mention, David, for you is you mentioned Pierre Boulez. Mm-hmm. He was a personal friend of yours.
Yes, very much so.
What is it like when you're playing your friend's music?
You know, it's a really interesting thing because I've been very blessed to work with all my heroes growing up. And so the list feels like name dropping when you start to mention them. And one of the things that it does is that you have a real visceral sense of who they are. And what's interesting for me is that by extension, going back in time, you get a much more visceral sense for composers who are no longer with us, who you did not get to know personally. And from their writing and how they wrote things down or how they conceived of things, you really become, in conductor Eric Leinsdorf's phrase, the composer's advocate. So although they can't necessarily be there and be present, you speak for them. And of course, I've been in the wonderfully fortunate position to do this for people I've worked with, whether it's Messiaen or whether it's Boulez or whether it's, you know, presently with John Adams, who happens to be here this week with his piece. And sometimes it's very exciting when you suggest something and the composer says, oh, that really sounds great. And that's a wonderful feeling.
You mentioned Messiaen. From what I've read of the reviews, it was received extraordinarily well in California during that trip.
Yes. You know, it's great to take the St. Louis Symphony out on tour because what happens is that people realize this incredible quality that the orchestra has here at St. Louis. And so it says much more than just the concert. Mm-hmm. You know, a few years back, there was a performance that we did at Carnegie Hall, which was remarked as being one of the best concerts in New York. It was one of the top five of the New York Times list at the end of the season. We performed Peter Grimes of Benjamin Britten on his 100th birthday. And the same newspaper that review came out in, which was singing the praises of the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra, although it was in the arts section, it was telling another side of the story on page one, where the reports were all about Ferguson and all of the difficulties St. Louis has. And so for us to be able to go out and tell the other side of a very complex and deep community is a really important part of what we do. And to show this enormous richness that St. Louis has to offer in terms of talent and in terms of breadth of offerings in the arts, that's something that we really relish being able to do on the road.
One of the things I've always wondered about, when you do go someplace else into another hall, how difficult it is for you and the orchestra to adjust to a new venue, new acoustics, new everything.
You know, it's interesting because it is a challenge, but one of the things that's absolutely fascinating, and we played in one hall in California, and I won't mention it because that would be impolite, and that's not a St. Louis thing to do. It's like the acoustics were designed by the same person who made the Nabisco saltine cracker. They are so dry that the notes come out of the wind instruments, and they look around the hall, and they rush right back up inside the bell. It's just awful. And what's so amazing, every time we've played there on a number of occasions, the orchestra at first comes in, and the sound is not right. And somehow every individual musician changes what they do so that after about 20 minutes, the sound is like the one we have in Powell Hall, because that's the ideal sound for the orchestra. They know what that is, and they will work tirelessly to get it. And so you have these performances where people are on their feet and saying, can't you please move here? And we said, no, the Rams did that. We have to go back. St. Louis is in our name.
Thanks to the St. Louis Symphony's president and CEO, Marie-Hélène Bernard, and its music director, David Robertson. The Symphony's 2016-2017 season opens on September 16th. Archived versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis On the Air is produced by Mary Edwards, Alex Hoyer, and Kelly Moffitt, with production assistance from Aaron Dorr, Lolita Brown, and Spencer Reed. The executive producer is Robert Peterson. Arts and culture programming on St. Louis On the Air is funded in part by the Arts and Education Council of Greater St. Louis, the Regional Arts Commission, and the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thanks for listening. I'm Don Marsh.